I'm someone who loves trying out different makeup looks, but doesn't really wear much on a daily basis, so I like to focus on making sure I have high quality staples. And whether you like a fresh face, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics' viral tubing mascara. I've certainly seen it everywhere. You know the one in the turquoise tube? So that mascara, along with all of Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products, are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free, which I look for in makeup, and they've got excellent quality to match. And something I didn't know from all the mascara videos I've seen is that for every product sold, Thrive Cosmetics donates either that same product, another product that is needed more, or a monetary donation. They've worked with over 500 nonprofits to help with a wide range of causes like supporting cancer survivors, people experiencing homelessness, education access, and so much more. Knowing that makes me feel even better about using their products. And I do enjoy using them. Like I said, I like having high quality staples, and so my favorites are products that are multi-purpose, like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It comes in a bunch of colors, and I like using them as eyeliner, eyeshadow, and even highlighter. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/thrive. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS. .com/thrive for 20% off your first order.
Anna Sheridan, missing for nearly 6 months now.
That's not possible. After that,
someone with a more vivid imagination might decide she'd pierced the veil. There's no place for ghost stories in this investigation or any other.
I need you to find me.
The Sheridan. A serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.
It's time for the Life Writing Podcast with your hosts, authors and screenwriters Stephen Barnes and Tanana Reeve Due. All about creating the project of your dreams while living a balanced artist life. Be the hero or heroine of your own story. Sponsored by LifeWritingPremium.com. Get ready to write for your life.
Welcome to the Life Writing Podcast, where married authors and screenwriters Stephen Barnes
and Tanana Reeve Due talk about writing during stressful times, breaking into Hollywood, and balancing life.
Every week, we'll share more tips on how to build a better life while you create your dream projects.
Even if it's only at the rate of one sentence a day. Life writing is the application of the tools of writing to life and the tools of life to your writing.
Woohoo! Hello. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. So happy everyone's here. You have reason to be excited. We have not one guest today, but two guests.
Two guests.
Which is so incredible for us to talk about their book, The Black Eye Dies First, Black Horror Cinema from Fodder to Oscar. But before we bring them on, and I'm going to give them the full introduction in just a few minutes. Steve, I'm glad you're still here. And you know what we like to do, right?
Yes, I do.
At the beginning, we like to talk about what's going on. Oh, that's a mood elevator.
Kind of a lesson that you can actually guide your mood with the music you play in the background of your life.
Oh, okay. Dropping the wisdom, Mr. Barnes. So what is going on? I think I'll start first today.
Please do.
Because we have gotten feedback on our story for the upcoming anthology set in the world of The Stand, The End of the World as We Know It. We wrote a short story called The Boatman, which I will now call by name because I'm pretty sure now we're in. We did not get rejected, so yay. I never took that for granted. I have been rejected in the past 3 to 4 years, so it happens.
It happens to everybody.
It happens, but it's tough to write a story in an existing world where you know a bunch of other writers are also tackling well-trod territory, right? So you don't want to repeat too many of the beats everybody else is doing, but you have to repeat some of the beats that people remember from The Stand. And I had a friend of mine, Nadine Pined, who's Haitian American, who helped me because our character is Haitian American. So she's helping me with some of those cultural references. And my cousin, Manco Kraza, who has a sailboat, helped me with the maritime references. So this is a well-researched little ditty that we
wrote.
It takes
a village.
It takes a village. I'm just glad they like the story. That part of me has never changed. I'm still that same 10-year-old right. kid who's like, oh, I hope you like it.
Yep. After 3 million words of fiction, you know, I was still on tenterhooks wondering when not the editor would like the Star Wars book that I just turned in, you know.
Oh, you mean the one that she said could be one of the greats?
Yeah, that one. That one. You know, which I should get the notes back for that next week, probably. And then I will have to get into the rewrite on that. So what I need to do is to push some other projects for the project I'm working with Larry Niven, the nonfiction book on the magic formula, and a few other things, and see if I can't find a way to take the experience that I had in Manila and that reintegrative process and let all of these stresses just, you know, move me on to the next level.
Yes.
You know, that question that I'm asking a different series of questions now. And it's very interesting. Part of the way I'd put it is that I'm more awake mm-hmm. than I was before. Whereas the term enlightenment relates to awakeness, I ain't enlightened. And you can recognize an enlightened person because they think non-dualistically. They never prefer one thing over another thing. They're just there. Mm-hmm. It's not useful in terms of existing in the world.
Not
so
really.
I'm not, you know, everybody gets there. According to the Sufi, everybody gets, you know, it's the door of awareness that opens at the moment of death. The seeker just tries to open it before they get there. But if you have family obligations, world obligations, then what's available to you is something called being a householder. Hmm. You can be very, very aware, but you're also taking care of your obligations to the world and your family. And that's what I am.
Yes, you are. You absolutely are.
It's a fascinating to have clarity on that now and to then try to say, well, let me bring this back into my work, into my parenting, into being the best husband I can be. You know, these things, it's purified. You know, spirituality is the removal of illusion, in essence. You know, the basic reality is spirit. Everything that does not seem spiritual is therefore an illusion. You dispel the illusions and what you're left with is the thing itself. You can't take that too far. You end up sitting in a cave forgetting to eat and the villagers better bring you a bowl of rice or you're going to starve.
You know, and too many artists do fall into that trap. It just
Absolutely.
Reminds me of that scene in Crooklyn. Remember Delroy Lindo playing Spike Lee's dad, fictionalized, of course, sitting at the piano, plunking out a tune
while the lights go off.
Yeah. Right? Oh my gosh. That is
absolutely
such a cautionary
Absolutely.
Tale.
And this is a problem that a lot of artists have. If you look at the artist personality as sort of the child part of you, you know, pure creativity just wants what it wants. The part of you that pays the bills is the adult part of you, you know, marketing, sales, networking, stuff like that. And if you have a good balance between those two things, then you have a healthy artist. Otherwise, you need to hire somebody to manage and supervise you and edit you and stuff like that. And those two parts often are antagonistic to each other. So I see that a lot in artists who say, I don't care about money and then complain that they're always broke. Mm-hmm. It's sad to watch.
All right, now don't be telling our listeners business.
Anyway, let's move on to whatever is next. What you got?
Well, horror is having a moment. I mean, horror is always having a moment, but it just feels like it's an even more sustained moment now. I will confess now that I overdid it on horror during the Halloween and Christmas seasons. And I'm just now coming back after a late night with the devil. I watched some horror over Easter weekend. So I'm starting to get back in the saddle with horror. And one of our guests is great at keeping me aware of what's coming up. Like I learned that the first Omen opens this week. So, this week on the day we're recording.
Yeah.
So
to see that tomorrow night if we want to.
Oh, that would be great. Oh, no, I'm going to Las Vegas. Oh, that's right.
On Thursday?
Yes, Thursday night.
Oh.
I'm going to Las Vegas. I have an event there. I would promote it, but it's sold out. But let's bring on our guests because I'm dying to talk to both of them. Hugely important, influential. The Black Guy Dies First, Black Horror Cinema from Fodder to Oscar is the book. The authors are Dr. Robin R. Means Coleman and Mark H. Harris. Dr. Coleman is a professor at the University of Virginia and the director of the Black Fantastic Media Lab, which sounds amazing. She's an internationally prominent and award-winning scholar. I mean, let's just break it down. If you've seen the documentary Horror Noir on Shudder, she's the reason for the season. It was her book that we were adapting into the documentary. I was an executive producer on that. She's also reissued it with a second edition, updating it for the present. But somehow in all that, and I know there's so much on your bio I'm not able to say here because you're just that amazing. But in addition to that, she hooked up with Mark Harris to write this book. And Mark H. Harris is an entertainment journalist who's written about cinema and pop culture for over 20 years for New York Magazine, Vulture, Rotten Tomatoes, About.com. He's also featured in Horror Noir as one of the scholars on Black horror and has his own social media presence where he is constantly updating me on what's new and exciting in the world of horror. Please welcome our guests, Dr. Robin R. Means Coleman and Mark H. Harris. I'm breathless after all, and there's so much I left out of the bios. That's the part.
An embarrassment of riches.
Thank you so much, both of you, for being on. I said in the green room earlier that I didn't even write down questions because this feels like it's just a long overdue lunch that the four of us, except without the food, unfortunately. But we do have the great company to really sort of share our love for horror, our frustrations with horror, and all of that. So I guess I just want to begin. I'm going to start like in the Wayback Machine with you, Robin. When did your love for horror first sprout and why?
Right. I tell this story often that I was born and raised in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And if you are a true horror fan, I need not say anything else, but if you need to buy a vowel, that is where George Romero filmed in and around Pittsburgh, Night of the Living Dead. And so for Pittsburghers, if you recall, Romero uses real life Pittsburghers in some of the scenes in Night of the Living Dead. So it felt a little bit biographical, a little bit more like a documentary than anything else. That infamous ending that we, 54-year-old, spoiler alert, when Ben gets killed at the end by the militia. Those are real life police officers. And we felt like, yep, he did it. We know who that is. That's our Pittsburgh experience. So interestingly enough, horror has been a constant presence in my life, along with the themes that horror sometimes brings around social justice and equality. And the treatment of Black people in society within Blackness and externally about how non-Blacks treat Black people. All of those themes came through horror and they resonated really from birth. And it starts with Night of the Living Dead.
I love that answer. How about you, Mark? But so Mark, where did your love for horror begin?
I've always had kind of a fascination with the dark side of life, I think. I actually have sort of similar ties to Robin in terms of I wasn't from the Pittsburgh area, but Night of Living Dead was one of the movies that really made an impression on me when I was younger. I remember renting an old VHS copy of it from the library when I was probably 12 or so and watching it. And, you know, I don't think my parents knew at all what I was getting from. I just had stacks of books and movies and stuff that I would get all the time. And that one just really jumped out at me because it was just seemed like this black and white movie that was just so old and ancient, and yet it seemed like it had this really modern edge to it. And it had this black lead character who was, you know, bossing around these white people and everything and saving the day and being, you know, the main hero. And it just struck me as really something revolutionary. Even in the time that I was watching it in the 80s. And even at that time, I think if Night of the Living Dead had come out with that sort of representation, it still would have been revolutionary at that time. So it was like two decades
ago. Oh, yeah.
Complete.
The 80s. Really, yeah. For sure.
Yeah. So, yeah. So I think that's something that really sticks in my mind. It's something that really jumpstarted my love for the genre.
That's amazing. And yeah, when you think about it, and I consider Romero is an ally, you know, he was not himself Black. And all the stories say it was just accidental casting. I've never been able to get anybody to say, "Oh, excuse me, you're shaking your head,
I
Robin."
don't, I absolutely don't believe that.
Okay, do you go
I mean,
on?
I've never interviewed George Romero about it. I've been in lots of spaces, and that it is true, like sort of over the years, storytelling and our memory of things evolves. But this sort of color notion of colorblind casting and just sort of saying we parachuted a black guy in and there was no impact. We had no idea that this would affect the ways in which people bring meaning to this role and take it away. I've never believed that. And as he received feedback about it, I, over the decades, I saw his position shift a bit on that, particularly when the remakes started to happen. And you would see him reflect more on the impact race had on the films.
It looked to me, what I believe, based on reviews, interviews that I've seen, is that he did not have that in mind when he wrote it, and he did not have that in mind when he cast it. But when Dwayne Jones walked in, he saw the implications. He did not understand them as deeply as he came to later on, but it was, this is the guy. This was something that suddenly elevated this piece of work. And he jumped on it like a dog on a bone. So I'm willing to believe he was not thinking about it until it was there, but when it was there, he got it.
Well,
I think,
what
yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Tanana Reef.
no need to apologize. I was just reflecting on how this is such a horror noir reunion to have it. We did talk about Night of the Living Dead, obviously, in horror noir, the documentary that's still on Shudder. And Mark was in it. Robin, you're in it, and it's also adapting your book. And I have to say, it wasn't until horror noir and that I came to think about why my mother in particular was drawn to horror, the relationship between trauma, specifically racial trauma in her case, and her love for horror that ironically often does not reflect Black people, at least historically. And if it did, it was not a compliment, as you discuss exhaustively in your book, The Black Guy Dies First. So I wanted to talk about that relationship of blackness to horror, even when, as I said, in horror noir, black people have always loved horror. It's just that horror hasn't always loved us.
Mark, you want to take it?
No, yeah, I mean, I've like I said, I've been a horror fan since I was young, and when I got into horror in the 80s, that was like kind of the peak Black Guy Dies First era, where if there even was a black person in the film, they were likely to be one of the first ones to die, and they would never be the hero, that sort of thing. And so I guess it says something about the appeal of the genre that I still stuck with it. I still loved it. Even though, you would see representations of yourself on screen, never being the hero or never saving the day. I think, it's something that really kind of just speaks to how, the genre speaks to you. I think it's something that, you would watch it and you would secretly, you would root for the black guy, but in the back of your head that, they're not gonna make it pretty, most of the
Yeah.
time. So I think just, kind of a love, I wouldn't say love hate, but love, like a love cringe type of dynamic where it's like, oh, can you just take it
Unrequited
to
love.
the first movie where I really noticed that and started thinking about it was Damnation Alley, where Paul Winfield gets eaten by the giant cockroaches. And I recognized the implications of that. And something started happening in me psychologically. If there was only one black person and they killed him, after that point, the sort of social unconscious meaning and value of that in terms of promoting the values of the filmmakers is to disorient you so that you will identify with the white people more than you identify with the black people. Because if you identify with the black people, you get pain. If you identify with the white people, you get to have a hero. So, and it's very similar to what Alfred Hitchcock did in Psycho, where he killed Janet Leigh, and suddenly you didn't know who to identify with because you thought she was the hero, and you end up identifying with Norman Bates, right? So what I would do is if they killed off all the black people, I would start identifying with the monsters. And I would enjoy watching them killing the white characters.
Uh-oh.
And this is exactly what I was not supposed to do. And then the reactions I've gotten from white people when I tell them that, I mean, what are they supposed to say? You know, it's, but I really don't. I just sit back with the popcorn and the sharks say, eat another one. All right, eat that kid over there. That's great. Those naked teenagers, eat
Robin, how did you navigate the complexity of that unrequited love?
I think there's two things. The first is it's interesting that you the quote that you identify from horror noir, the one that so I do this sort of talk about Black horror, and there's a section in this talk that I do that's a little bit performative where I quote you, Tanana Reeve, because the most powerful quote is when you say Black history is Black horror. That puts people, sort of you see people sit back and reflect on that. That's a powerful quote. That's my love hate. This sort of Black history is Black horror. There's so many complexities and layers to that statement, which is so powerful. Both our relationship, which I sort of started where I started with Night of the Living Dead and talking about real life Black history, horrors, and trauma, and then the way that horror films, particularly Black horror films, take that up. And it doesn't mean that all Black horrors are message films or social justice, but even when they are not apolitical, right? They are powerful responses to the ways that we've been treated both on and off screen. And so for me, I think that your quote was really kind of centering to say, Black history is Black horror. There's an affirmative side to that as well, right? Our Black history and the ways that we talk back to that can be found and often only found in Black horror, not Blacks in horror, but Black horror. And that's how I manage that.
You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
That's great. Of course, that's a great answer, as usual. Well, you'd written Horror Noir, the documentary's done. How did you two meet during the making of the documentary? Did you already know each other? And when did you decide, hey, we need to write a book together?
Fun fact, we've never actually met in person.
So wow. That's
but I mean, I think Robin can shed a little more light than I can probably in terms of how we actually connected, because he called me out of the blue one day after the book had come out, and I'd read the book, and I noticed she'd given me a little shout out in the opening of it. So I was like, oh wow, that's cool. He knows who I am. So, but she called me out of the blue one day and just kind of, we were just chatted a little bit. I don't know how she got my number. I don't know how she knew anything about, you know, how to contact. I don't know how she knew my name, frankly, because I don't know if it's on my site or not, but she kind of did some sort of FBI investigation, I think, and got a hold of me. And we just chatted for a bit, you know, kind of she talked about, you know, what I kind of wanted to do with my site or with, you know, my kind of knowledge of Black horror. And we kind of just kept in touch for a few years. And then I think she was approached after the documentary came out and it was such a success. I think our mutual friend, Joe Monti, saw it and he loved it, and he wanted to do a book that was kind of a follow-up to the documentary because he liked it so much, and he wanted it to kind of be sort of less academic, I guess, than the original Horror Noir book. And so I guess, you know, he approached Robin about it, and Robin kind of thought to herself, who do I know who can dumb down this material to make it palatable to the mass market? So she called me.
I don't know that that's exactly what she was thinking.
No, not true.
But anyway, Joe Monti, by the way, is my editor for the Reformatory at Saga Press, and we share now an editor in common. Robin, what's dumbed down, really? Is that what you thought?
Not even close. Our origin story is in some way, well, so first, let me say that I always give a shout out to Mark's family, who has been his wife and the kiddos who've been so patient. Like, I suddenly appear in their lives, and it does go back several years, so they're patient. And it was while I was writing the first edition of Horror Noir, and it actually sort of even predates that, when I wrote my first, this is on the academic side, book about the history of situation comedy. So I'm a genretist, right? I needed to have a full and complete list of every Black sitcom that ever aired in the history of television.
Wow.
When I shifted, and I had to research all of that myself, and there were all of these, and I was trying to include things that were pilots but never aired. When I shifted to horror, I was doing the same thing, and Mark's website, blackhorrormovies.com, saved me. It was so complete, just as you started talking at the top of the show, so comprehensive. And if you checked it almost every 72 hours, Mark was telling you what was coming up next, and he was also looking back at some really great classics. You know this as a scholar, we have to also give credit where credit's due. And so I wanted to shout him out. I wanted to cite him, but it felt like that wasn't sufficient to recognize the impact that his sight and his labor had on me. So I did all of that in the first book, but then I did think that there was a real opportunity to partner, and that was absolutely going to be my benefit and my honor. Mark certainly could have done all of these projects on his own and been fabulous without me. So let's be clear about who was bringing the talent here. Dumbing down, not it. In fact, he sort of loosened me up. I think Mark writes sort of subtle humor because I was so in the academic space. And I would say, even in our editing process, there were sometimes three and four kind of really funny jokes kind of stacked on top of each other. That speaks to not only his humor, but also how prolific as sort of a thinker he is in his writing process, because I know this is about writing. So that's kind of our origin story, as I called him during the first book and said, and we need to work together. And he was like, okay. And I was and then I never forgot it. There was actually three calls. Then there was another one where I was like, don't forget about me. We're gonna work together someday soon. And my husband is sitting there like, what are you doing? It's really funny, actually.
That's
And
great.
it finally happened. And it was absolutely my great honor. It was such an easy partnership. It really was. There was not a lick of, like conflict or pushback, or it was just same page. And I do think one of the, because I'm also saying this, I don't think nobody's ever asked the question, so Mark has never heard this. One of the things that I'm most grateful for, which speaks to a theme that you talked about, is how Black people sort of, Steve, you were saying, when they kill off a Black person, we may root for the monster or not. And what I appreciate, it was Spider Baby that was a theme that carries across the book, that was Mark's idea and contribution. And the ways in which Mantan Moreland shows up at the beginning of Spider Baby, only sort of, he doesn't even have a name. He's just called the Messenger. And his sole purpose is not only to die first, but to draw on that Black history is Black horror moment where we know him as this sort of comic relief. And they're bringing all of that to bear in his, sort of annihilation. And I think that shifted. It certainly did, right? As a principal sort of theme and thrust of the Black guy dies first. And there's a ton of people, you'd be surprised, who don't know this film, who point to it as probably singularly the most instructive moment in the book, and it's the framing moment, and that was Mark.
Wow. Well, that, yeah, all of that. I have not seen that movie. I didn't, in fact, it was reading your book. I even heard about it for the first time. And I was like, Mantan Moreland in 1968. Oh no, they didn't do him like that. But one chapter that really jumped out at me was the one on The Shining, because I did have that very visceral reaction, having read the book, watching the movie in the theater at a young age, knowing Scatman Crothers and his work previously. I'm still not over it. So with that story in mind, and for those of you who don't know, Scatman Crothers dies very unceremoniously in The Shining with an axe to the chest. Like, as soon as he walks to the door, when in the novel by Stephen King, he survived the story.
I
So
think
that
it's
was
even worse than that. Remember that he has the shining too. He has
true.
precognition. He is down in Florida or wherever he is and gets a precognitive flash that this kid is in trouble, travels all the way there, gets a snowmobile, travels across all this land. He knows that there is extreme danger. Then he walks in there like an idiot and just gets hit in the chest with an axe. That is sacrificial Negro combined with spiritual guide in just the worst sense. by a director I love but did not love me, very clearly, based on stuff in Dr. Strangelove and Full Metal Jacket. Kubrick had problems.
So bearing The Shining in mind, I would love to know from both of you what you want to accomplish with this book. What's the main message you want your readers to absorb in reading these pages? Or it doesn't have to be related to The Shining. You could just talk about The Shining and not answer my question. Do whatever y'all want.
One interesting thing about The Shining that I when I go down the rabbit hole of being like, you know, all pessimistic about our portrayals and stuff in these movies, I do remind myself something like, with The Shining, you could look at it like the Scatman Crothers character actually did end up saving the day because he brought the snow cat to them that they then were used to escape from, you know, from the house at the end. So in some way you can say that he did save the day, even though he did die. So he was kind of, you know, the heroic slash sacrificial Negro, but he did, you know, play his part, I guess, in terms of saving the day. So that's, you know, and that kind of ties in, I guess, to what I kind of want people to take away from the book is that, you know, there are these portrayals that are, you know, on the surface, negative, historically speaking, but that things, you kind of have to take things with a grain of salt. You kind of have to look at, you know, how things were portrayed at the time. So, you know, at the time, you know, these things were just kind of viewed as how they were. This was the Black role, that sort of thing. And so you kind of have to look at how things have evolved over the years. So I'd say that, you know, as society has evolved to where we are now, the roles have similarly evolved. So I think it kind of, the book kind of portrays the evolution from the late 60s to now in terms of not only portrayals within media, but also within society. And so we kind of trace the history of all these different stereotypes and roles and these little boxes that they put Black characters in. But then we also talk about how things have gotten better in recent years, how, you know, things have really exploded, especially since Get Out hit the scene. Things have gotten just exponentially greater, you know, in terms of both quality and quantity in terms of Black roles in horror. And so I think that's kind of the whole thrust of the book, is just kind of tracing that evolution from, you know, Potter to Oscar, as the title says.
How about you, Robin? Because you've already done such comprehensive work about Black horror, but as you said, Joe was like, how about something more commercial and less scholarly?
And certainly that, right? The horror noir is absolutely sort of a scholarly kind of textbook for advanced undergraduate, graduate students and researchers. And that leaves a significant audience that's untapped. And that is sort of the general public readership, the kind of smart public. And what I wanted them to take away, which I think we captured, at least based on feedback, is that we also really love the genre, that there's a love for horror. There's a love for the way that Black people show up in the genre. And we really wanted to invite people in and to capture that. So as an example, in one of my classes some years ago, I would always show, for some reason, we would see a clip of Saving Private Ryan. Saving Private Ryan has got to be one of the most violent, bloody, you know, sort of movies there is. And nobody blinks when you show Saving Private Ryan, not even in the classroom. You will never get a complaint from a student to your department chair or dean about, she showed this incredibly violent thing in the class. And I was curious as to why then people, if you ask anybody, they'll say, oh no, I'm not a horror fan. Oh no, it's too violent, it's too bloody. And I'm like, oh, okay. And at the same time, right, so they're missing this whole genre. Although I will say, people who say that are then able to go through some long list of horror movies that they have seen. So the watch out for those folks who say that they're not the non-horror fan. But what I also wanted people to take away is in the same, that we can have the exact same conversation about a Saving Private Ryan, about reflecting and about what's happening in our socio-political world, as we can through the horror genre. And particularly Black horror isn't necessarily nearly as violent or graphic or bloody as even a Saving Private Ryan type movie. And so I thought that there were opportunities for people to better understand our world. And, you know, a lot of sugar, a lot of humor with that understanding, and a lot of joy and sort of come into the genre. I think that was communicated really well.
That's great. And I remember when Horror Noir came out on Shudder, the documentary, that I was bracing for a blowback because so much of it is teaching. Like, hey, you love horror? I bet you didn't notice this happened, or I bet you never thought about this. And the viewers were just so happy to be taught. That's what really kind of shocked me, was that I didn't see a lot of blowback. It was more, oh, thank you so much. Oh, we want more. And I think that does speak to your spirit coming through, and both of you in this book. I definitely did notice the emphasis on humor, which makes it fun to digest. But of course, the evil side of me wants to ask you, was there something you came across through your research for this, or something that you were very happy to share that is just so egregious, that is like so over the top, like how could they do this? Or have we already covered the major offenders?
You know, I'd like to say something really quick.
Sure.
I think one of the reasons why people responded well to Horror Noir is that you were showing a wide range, and you can see how much things have changed and how positively things have changed. So to both bring people an awareness, but also allow them to think, wow, things were so bad back then. We may still have issues, but things are better now. Mm. I think that that is actually a positive thing and allows them to wake up without feeling guilty for things that they themselves did not do, and to feel optimistic about where we're going as a culture.
Yeah, because there are a lot of films that people like and they just sort of absorb uncritically. And then you point out, did you notice this terrible trope, this sacrificial Negro trope, this first to die trope? And the light bulb goes off. Any egregious ones popping out, or?
I am, you know what? Mark, you will have to remind me of the title. I was trying to Google it really quickly because my brain doesn't always work. Vanity, of Vanity Six Fame. What was that? What was that movie called? Oh,
you talking about Anya's Island? I think it was.
Yes.
Oh, she's being raped by an orangutan or something.
Oh my gosh.
So Vanity of Vanity Six is in an abusive relationship. For some inexplicable reason, she's on this like remote deserted island. And so she befriends like an ape, and then it turns super erotic, and she's flirting with and kind of rubbing on this ape. I mean, this is not, then you're like, oh, Ngoggi, son of Ngoggi. Okay. Cause
1940.
She kind of gets involved with this ape, but now she's got this kind of hypersexualized ape after her, as well as her abusive partner.
What?
And then, yeah, and then the ape rapes her, but it's super sensual and erotic.
What?
And it's, and you're just like, what? That was the one for me.
Was that the 80s?
When did that come out? Yes. Yeah. That's the 80s. 1980.
What in the world? That is horrible. And I mean, that just brings up so many stereotypes, you know, the sexualization of Black women in this fetishized way, which is another trope that can happen in horror. Yeah. Just ew. I want to take a shower after just hearing about that movie.
Really should. Like, it's really bad. Which one is Mark?
The only one I can think of right now is just, I think, that pops into mind is them, the miniseries. It was, we cover movies. The book is about movies, but we kind of made an exception for them, which is a miniseries rather than a movie, because it kind of fit into, you know, our discussion of in that chapter about, you know, I guess, trauma porn and you know, sort of representations. And so I think that one, you know, it just, I'm very conflicted about it because it's a well-made show, I guess. And
it
has good production value and good acting. And there are parts that are thought-provoking and interesting. But it just seems like it crossed that line between kind of exploration and exploitation, and it kind of just kind of veered into sort of gleefully portraying some of the violent events, like the one with the baby especially still sticks with me in terms of, you know, this white family just breaks into this house and just grabs the baby and starts slinging it around in a sack or whatever and kills it. And it's just like, it's so over the top, and it just kind of set a tone for it overall. And so even though I can't say I hated it as a whole, it definitely had some elements that really, you know, call for commentary in the book. So,
you know, and what's interesting about those two examples, the one from 1980, I'm imagining was not a Black created movie, that, you know, that there were no Black people in the meetings.
I'm taking a look at the IMDb, and it looks, I'm not entirely certain because one actor does not have a picture up there, but it looks like everybody, all the creative people were white, is what it looks like to me, including some, you know, good special effects people. Rob Bottin and I think Rick Baker were involved.
So stomach it's churning.
To understand that films are extensions of the fantasies of the people who make them, allows, and then if they're successful films, then they are satisfying the fantasies of the people buying the tickets. Therefore, images in film are a great way to take a look at the unspoken values of the audience and the filmmakers. They can say anything they want to, but if they're supporting that movie and making that movie, they like it.
Right. And then when you look at them, which, you know, as far as I know, is Black created, you know, Little Marvin and et cetera. Although I have no doubt there were a lot of white people also behind the camera involved with that. I think it's a slightly different phenomenon that happens. And I think it's something similar that happened when a Black director was adapting one of my books. I'm not going to mention the director or the work, but that last draft went over the top in terms of depicting lynchings and things that weren't even in the story. And I think what happens is sometimes when Black creators have that megaphone and that mouthpiece and that opportunity, they just want to yell, look what you did to us, you know? And that's not entertainment. And that's the difference. I think people forget horror as a genre is meant to be entertaining. And who is entertained by watching a lynching, which is basically, Mark, what you were saying, that scene with the baby is a lynching. That is a white mob comes into your house and kills your child. And I will say this, though, I've had a peek at season two. I don't think I signed an NDA, so I think I'm allowed to say it does avoid, I think, a lot of the trauma porn traps of season one. I'll leave the viewers and listeners to decide if they think it's good, but it's not season one. I will say that. So evolution, yeah. A lot of this is about evolution. And speaking of evolution, because we don't want to just sort of stay mired in what's not working, how are you feeling about where we are right now, culturally, in terms of Blackness and horror specifically?
I think we're still in the midst of a renaissance for Black horror. I mean, I think it really kicked off with Get Out, although it was still a ramp up. You know, before Get Out, I think it was still ramping up before that. But I think Get Out really kicked things into the stratosphere just because, you know, Hollywood won't take pay attention until a movie actually makes a lot of money. So that one really, it hit on both sides. It hit, you know, the critical side and the commercial side. And so it was just kind of kicked things into the stratosphere. And, you know, Hollywood wants to jump on anything they think can be the next big thing. So they've kind of put their efforts towards, you know, series of Black movies, you know, or horror movies with Black leads. And it's still, you know, continuing today. I think, you know, we still I keep a tabulation on my side of, like, you know, movies every year with Black leads. And so I've kind of charted the progression, and it's really still on the upswing, I think, right now. I mean, we have movies this year with like Imaginary came out recently this year. We got the next movie with, was it the Quiet Place movie coming out with?
Oh, with Lupita.
Lupita's going to star in that one. So we've got these roles that aren't at all specific to Blackness, I guess. You know, that historically, you know, Hollywood only cast Black people as a lead in a movie that, you know, revolves around, you know, the hood or some sort of aspect of quote-unquote Black culture. But these are just kind of generic kind of, you know, Imaginary is just like, you know, this suburban household and this imaginary character, imaginary friend. So I think Hollywood is really opening up in terms of being able to cast Black leads in these movies that aren't quote unquote Black specific roles. And so I think, you know, that is really opening up the possibilities. I think, you know, as we've seen in the past, Hollywood goes in cycles though. So I think I'm still kind of apprehensive because, you know, I know that the first sign of any sort of thing where Hollywood can get a sense of, oh, people don't want to see Black people in horror anymore, that can just dry up just as quickly as it did in the 70s and 80s.
It absolutely will. And this is why it's so critical for us to get into the executive suite and into the technical professions in Hollywood. The only answer, as far as I'm concerned, is for full diversity behind the camera. Because Hollywood is going to go in those cycles. It's just a machine in that sense. But as long as we have some people, as we're creating more Jordan Peeles and Ryan Cooglers and so forth, that can make money doing this.
And Nikki Atujisus, who did Nanny.
Right. That's right. You know, we're not going to go back as, you know, you can't unscramble an egg. And so every time we take a step, it changes the culture. And when the culture is changed, you can't go back to the way things were. You can try to. I mean, we have political movements that are happening right now because people are trying to put the scrambled egg, the omelet back into the eggshell. They can't do it. But it's going to be painful for some of us. But I think that we need to have faith that as these cycles change, you know, it's just a cycle. We're just little human beings moving through this. And I believe that what I have seen is that every generation, since I first started noticing this stuff, things have been getting better. And there is resistance from the people who are afraid of that change. But the backlash that we're getting, as far as I'm concerned, is because we are being so successful. You know, the
winning.
The only thing I would be afraid of is if we're inferior. If we're not inferior, we're going to win this game. You know, it's as simple as that.
And Robin, do you agree we're in a renaissance still?
Yeah, well, yes. So I quibble over words a little bit too much. And because people were using the language of renaissance to point to Jordan Peele, to Get Out, Us, and Nope, I felt a little bit prickly about that because I felt like it erased the earlier contributions. And so I think Mark is right. There's been this long ramp up. But I don't want us to lose the Spencer Williams, the Eloise Gifts, the Rusty Cundiefs. Like, there's been people who have been putting work in this genre for a really long time. And they didn't get on AMC or Regal Cinema big screens through that distribution. But that doesn't mean that they weren't moving the genre forward. So I get the Renaissance talk around the mainstreaming of Black horror, but Black horror has been around for a century, or else I wouldn't have a book called, you know, 1890s to present. So there's, you know,
true.
I just want to say that.
No, I love that. I love that. You know, I know, Robin, you're one of the busiest people I know. Mark, I don't know where you find the time, as Robin said, to keep your website so updated. The social media presence alone is so time consuming. How do you balance all the things you want to get done and keep stress at bay? What are your tools? Because as you mentioned, this is a podcast largely for writers, not exclusively, but a lot of our folks are writers. So what are your tips for dealing with deadlines, dealing with stress, but keeping in balance with your life?
Well, for me, I guess I have a couple. I mean, one, as I'm aging, I'm realizing the power of getting enough sleep. So I kind of had to prioritize being well rested, because if I'm not, I can't think, I can't like even think of what I'm supposed to be doing at a certain time. And, you know, I just need, you know, you really need that 8 or so hours or whatever your body, your personal body needs to function. And the other thing I think is just kind of, I'd say, find your own private bathroom. And by that, I mean, find a place where you can really focus, sit and focus without any distraction. For me personally, in a house with a wife and two kids, that tends to be the bathroom, which is not the ideal place, but I just know that's a place where I can kind of just go in, close the door. I have like a fan to like block out sound. I don't have any distractions, like even my personal distractions, like TV or anything like that. I can block all that out and I can kind of focus on what I need to do for, you know, an hour or two or whatever I need. So find your own personal, either literal or metaphoric bathroom where you can kind of have a space that, you know, you can really focus on what needs to be done.
You are the first guest to ever give that advice, and I love it. Have your own bathroom. What about you, Robin? You are so busy.
Right. So I actually sort of focused on this part of the assignment to prep for our meeting. And I say this a lot in different contexts. And my first sort of piece of advice that I try to hold close to my heart is don't haze yourself. Don't haze yourself. And what I mean by that is we started at the top of the hour sort of talking about like everybody gets a rejection. And the particularly the students, undergraduate, graduate, and faculty folks that I advise or coach, hold on to those rejections. They will have a million yeses, but that one no is something that they just can't shake. And it will linger with them. They will be able to remember who said it, what date, what journal, or what publisher, and they can't let it go.
I have a certain Amazon review that I feel that way about.
Right. And it's like one, and it doesn't, everything else outweighs that one, those one or two moments. And all we also said at the top of the hour, yeah, everybody gets a rejection, right? Those things happen. But on the whole, I would just say, don't haze yourself. And it isn't just around rejections. It is also about your writing practice. You don't write like other people write. And so, you know, I hear people advise, park your butt in the chair, sit there for 8 hours, clear your calendar. And then people who can't meet that kind of methodology around productivity, they sort of beat themselves up. That's hazing yourself as well. Let all of that go. The other thing I often tell people is that how you wrote for your dissertation, your MFA, your master's thesis, those were different assignments. This is not that. And so find your voice, your writing voice in that. My dissertation, it's terrible. Like I wish, I'm so afraid that some crazy is going to come and say, let's look at Robin's dissertation. Like they did Claudine Gay at Harvard. They won't do that with me.
Right.
And look for plagiarism. I'm like, there's no plagiarism, but just please don't read it, right? Because those documents are for a different assignment, right? You've got to prove that you know how to do independent research. It is not about finding your voice. It isn't about telling the story. That's a whole different assignment. Let that go, right? Because to hold on to that and struggle and fight against that is also hazing yourself. So my advice is that you'll feel more lifted if you stop hazing yourself. And then my second piece of advice is there's always an app for that. And so to write, given that I have all of the jobs, is that I use 750words.com. And it's a website where you do a daily writing practice if you can. Like it encourages you to do that. It encourages you to hit 750 words and it gives you all kinds of feedback about words you use a lot or overuse.
Oh,
and if you want
shoot.
Community, you can do that. But again, don't haze yourself. Just because it says 750 words doesn't mean that if you can't hit that, that you're a problem. I've never hit 750 words. I use that site and I try to get 50 words a day. And often with all of the jobs I have, I don't. And but for those who don't know, faculty member, I was a vice president, I was an associate provost, I was teaching, I was researching, I was like doing all this stuff. So I use that to write 50 words and see how that goes. And sometimes I would hit 50 words 3 times a week, but that it was the chipping away, not parking your butt for 8 hours, that I think is really helpful. So those are the ways in which if you're kinder and gentler to yourself, then the wellness, at least in this very narrow slice of the writing practice, will follow.
Oh my gosh,
you said something
I love it.
That is going to enable us to segue right into our, you know, talking about something, but I wanted to point out that an underlying structure, an underlying focus of what you just said is understand what the assignment actually is. Don't add more to it than there is. In other words, what is the thing? What is actually necessary to do in order to pass this gate? don't carry more baggage than you have to. You identified what was actually necessary at this point to get your doctorate, and then at this point in order to create a book, and you recognize they were not the same things at all. And I wanted to congratulate you for that and to extract from that so that people can notice when you're doing something, are you really clear on what's necessary to do in order to get this done? Because if you are, then that leads to the second thing you said. 50 words a day, fantastic. We encourage people to do one sentence a day. If you will just do one sentence a day, the way I put it is, that's your only work. Everything after that is play. You want to keep writing? That's great. But in terms of the work that you have to do, one sentence. If you can leverage yourself to there, you could take the rest of the day off and feel like a winner. But as soon as you feel like a winner, there's no pressure. And the little kid inside you says, I've got more to say. I want to say more of this. It's that question of what's the homework? What's the work, as opposed to what is the pleasure? The entire program that we created for writers is about understanding things like what Robin and Mark are saying about how to perform at a high level in this very, very specific arena. It is, you know, based on, you know, it is a year-long course that Tananarive and I created that has lectures and conversations from people who are real writers, who are actually doing this, so that you're not necessarily going to believe everything that we're saying, but we're speaking honestly to you. And so far, no one has listened to a single lecture without feeling like they learned something. They got something, even if it was via negativa. I won't do it like that, but I'll do it like this. Tananarive, take it away. What is your feeling about this?
Well, I love what Robin said about not hazing yourself, because I think the sentence a day approach is a very gentle approach, but there are also people who will berate themselves because they didn't write a sentence yesterday, or they didn't write a sentence on Monday, and see that as some kind of proof that they're not a real writer. And don't you dare. The sentence a day is inspirational, and that's the way it's supposed to be. I use it. I'm working on a book right now. I'm doing more than a sentence. But, you know, when you're just starting a new book, when you're juggling a lot of different projects, you know, there's that point where it feels like typing, and then it comes to life and 2 hours have gone by and you forgot you were writing. And that's what we're all aiming for. We can't always get there. So the Life Writing Premium Program is weekly prompts to remind you. It's very similar, probably in some ways, to that great website that Robin was talking about. It's like,
that's your a great sounding website. I love that website.
Looking at it. I like it. Even as an advanced writer, I'm always looking for new tools to make it more fun, or to just make sure I don't fall off the horse. So yeah, whether it's my lectures from the Geneva Writers Conference or lectures I did when I was teaching in the MFA program at Antioch University, Life Writing Premium is a combination of both of our voices. Weekly digital downloads. Check it out at lifewritingpremium.com. I wish we had 3 hours to spend with Mark and Robin. Where can people find you on the internet if they want to continue following your work or even reaching out to you?
We were so bad at this. Have you increased your social media presence, Mark?
He has.
Have you?
I've been trying.
You're on Threads, for God's sake.
Are you really?
Yeah. After Twitter turned to X, I kind of was like, let me explore my options. So I'm on Threads. I'm on Instagram. I even joined TikTok a couple months ago.
Right, so did I. So did I.
So not my preferred avenue, but I'm there. And I'm trying my best.
and of course you have your great, you still have your website.
Yes, blackhorrormovies.com. Yep. I'm not updating it with views as much as I used to, because I'm trying to do some other writing stuff, but yeah, I definitely at least update the new releases and that sort of thing every week. So, yep.
Beautiful. I love it. And what about you, Robin?
Well, clearly I need to catch up now. So I promise I'm going to get on Threads. I do have an Instagram account, so I will actually be active in that. I'm so old school. I'm still very much present on Facebook. And most people just email me at my university. So those are the best places right now.
Well, this has been so much fun. If you have not seen it or read it yet, definitely do check out the book, The Black Guy Dies First, Black Horror Cinema from Fodder to Oscar. And hopefully, with those inspirational words, listener, go out and make yourself the hero or heroine of your own story.
The hero in the adventure of your lifetime.
Bye-bye, everybody.
You've been listening to the Life Writing Podcast. Join us next time for more conversations about creating the project of your dreams. For more information, go to lifewritingpremium.com and get ready to write for your life.